Okay, so Parshat Breshit. So, anyway, I've never seen so much hatred being spewed on the airwaves, on social media, in the papers. Writers that over the years I've developed a respect for just can't seem to hold their cynicism, their anger back from what they're writing. And you sort of have to remind yourself that you have to take everything with a grain of salt. What are the facts? I read an article, which was actually an anti-Democrat article. It was just blasting Joe Biden's last 40 years, and he's never made a policy, a foreign policy decision correctly, and all this type of thing. And I'm reading this, and I realized there were two things missing from the article. One was sources. This guy is just, and this is an article. This is not an op-ed. And spewing all, and don't get me wrong, I'm not really a pro. I don't like to talk politics and cheer, but I'm not a pro Democrat or pro Republican. I like to look at candidates based on their positions and whatever. But and the second was, there wasn't even an attempt to hide his objectivity. And the paper I was reading this in was trying to balance opinions, so they had another article from someone who was very pro Biden, and just so much spewing. I don't know another way to describe it. And it gets you thinking, like, what really are our problems today? I mean, we're sitting here, and many of us are in quarantine in some form of isolation. And, it's easy to kind of get a little wallowed in sort of all the problems. We're stuck in our rooms, et cetera. I haven't experienced the isolation that you have, but I've had my share of isolation in life. I remember, being 5 or 6 weeks in Lebanon in an area of, about 200, 300 square yards. Wearing flak vests and helmets and everything else. Every time I had to, walk out of my bunk, sleeping in my uniform, it's the closest equivalent I can think of to the reality today of wearing masks and everything. It gets very intense. And so you tend to sort of think of the problem. If you had to pick the biggest issue today, the thing that we most need to fix, what would you say it is? Michael Hammer, what do you think? Biggest issue today. Right? What would you say? Of all the issues facing the world or the Jewish people, you can choose either. What would you say it is?
Can I say coronavirus?
Okay, so you want to say the coronavirus.
Not the right answer.
All right, the coronavirus. Okay. All right. Biggest issue today, coronavirus. Everybody else agree? Anybody else want to pick something
else?
Maybe
not the biggest, but probably the most pressing.
The most pressing. Well, by my definition, the biggest issue is the most pressing. In fact, Mendy, what do you want to say?
People's actions towards others in response to the coronavirus.
Actions towards others. Okay. Creating what? Healthier behavior, healthy empathy. Okay. Anybody else have an opinion? I want to vehemently disagree with both of you. Okay. I don't think that's the biggest issue today. I think those are symptoms of the biggest issue. When I was first teaching, it was even before I ever had a full-time teaching job, I was studying for Smicha, and I took a job teaching Mishnah in the mornings, and then eventually they hired me to teach first graders, sort of whatever. And I had this group of first graders in my class, and I taught them for like a couple hours in the morning, whatever it was. And then I went to yeshiva and learned. And when you teach, just like in every reality that we have, the first question is, what are your goals? I had a very clear goal for those first graders. They wanted me to teach them Yoshua Shoftim, right? The beginning of Navi, the beginning of the prophets. And it was clear to me that my goal was not that I should be able to meet them 4 years later and see if they could recognize the Rashis on Yoshua's dialogue with an angel, right? I wasn't even sure that the goal was that they should know the whole story of Yeshua. How many of you remember all the things you learned in first grade? So I decided that my goal was that they should love coming to school at the beginning of second grade as much as they loved coming to school at the beginning of first grade. And how to do that in a healthy way. That was my goal. So I did all sorts of things. I played games with them. I would bring my guitar. I remember when we got to the story of David and Goliath, I made this huge mock-up. I figured out, based on the different machlokas of what an ama is, how tall Goliath would have been. And I made an actual mock-up and hung it up on the wall. And I wanted the kids to see, these little first graders, how big this giant must have been. And then I picked them up, right? Everybody wanted to be picked up. It was a lot of fun, right? There was one kid, no matter what we did, he never looked happy. He just never looked happy. He always looked sad. And I would try to engage him. I'd try to get him to laugh. But he would act out. He was a bit of a troublemaker. You know, one day I caught him pulling a girl's hair in the class, and I had to put him in the corner. Like, all this type of stuff, right? And one day I noticed he came in, and he had a nasty black and blue mark near his elbow. And I asked him, like, what happened? And I touched the thing, and he pulled his arm away, right? And he said he fell. I said, oh, okay, you know, whatever. And I gave him a lollipop, whatever. And then a few weeks later, I noticed another bruise. Anyway, you can figure out where this is going. We had done a seminar for a day before we started teaching, which was standard practice. I'm sure it still is. And kind of the light went off in my head, and I realized, you know, this kid might be suffering from more than just falling down. You know, and one day he came in with a black eye and claimed he fell down, like on stairs or something. So I went to the school, I think vice principal, and they called in a social worker, and eventually they found out that he was being abused, right? And I started rethinking the whole first half of the year and how many times I had disciplined this kid, and I tried to do it in a nice way. Here's a kid who's being taught that hitting is the only way to get anything you want. And that when you don't like something, you lash out. And that's exactly what he's doing. And he's 5, 6 years old. And I felt like this little that I put that kid in a corner. Like, I should be sitting in the corner. And it made me realize that the root issue of everything that we have, of everything we do, of all the mistakes we make, is education. If you ask people what the biggest problem facing the Jewish world today is, some people will say assimilation. Assimilation is not the issue. It's a symptom of the issue. The issue is Jewish education. Some people say the Middle East peace crisis. You know, that the Arabs hate us and we can't make peace. That's not the problem. That's a symptom of the problem, right? Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu just signed an agreement of normalization / peace with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates. And when you watch some of the reactions, you realize there's a flaw in the way people are being educated, in the way they communicate, etc. You know, the issues that people have with the different candidates, it's all about education. You see a candidate who's basically a narcissistic, I don't know what to call him, right? Certainly not a role model. At least, again, we don't really know who a person is. We can only judge by what we see, and we don't really see the full reality. But based on what we see, it certainly seems he's a narcissistic person and not a role model. So if that's the case, right? But that's not the issue. The issue is the education he received as a kid, maybe the education his grandfather received, and so on and so forth, right? So that seems to be the biggest problem of the day. Now, bearing that in mind, and you can imagine, I mean, I've had many opportunities to experience this. You know, when we fought in the Intifada, one of the biggest challenges we had was children, because they taught children to throw rocks, and they taught children to use knives, and they just horrendous things. What do you do if a seven-year-old kid, you know what a rogatka is? A rogatka is it's like a type of slingshot, but it's not a slingshot that you pull back like what you see in the movies. It's this thing that you or mekach, there are different names for it. You swing it around your head, and then you flick it with your wrist, right? And it's a deadly weapon. It's actually similar to what they used in the time of David HaMelech. It's a sling, that's what it is, right? David HaMelech used this to fell Goliath. And these kids were experts, and they could take a marble, not the little ones, you know, those big marbles, there's one in every box of marbles, right? They would put these in this sling, swing it around, and they could hit targets at like 100 yards away. Now, if you're in the army and somebody's slinging one of those marbles at you and it hits you in the eye, you'll lose your eye. Never mind if it hits you in certain, if it hits your knee. I remember there was a Samach Mempe, a deputy company commander, who was on Miluim and reserve duty, the unit before we got to this particular area. And they told us what had happened to him. He was hit by one of these sling marbles by a kid. These marbles go 70, 80 miles an hour. And it hit his knee, totally shattered his knee. He was done with reserve duty for the rest of his life. And this put the fear of God into us. People took newspapers and wrapped newspapers around different parts of their body when we went to, like, in your pants, when you went to a riot. But what do you do about that? Like, it's a six-year-old kid. You can't blame the six-year-old kid. There's something completely flawed in the system of education. So bearing that in mind, right, I want to share with you an interesting discussion. This is the first Rashi in the entire Torah. Okay? The first Rashi in the entire Torah. Purposely picked this Rashi because many of you know this Rashi. So even if you don't have it in front of you, you'll be able to relate to this, all right? Breshit bara Elokim. Does anybody remember what the question of the first Rashi is? Remember I told you when you learn Rashi and you see what Rashi says, you have to ask yourself, what's bothering Rashi? What's the question Rashi has? Anybody remember what the first question of the first Rashi in the Torah is? This is Parshat Breshit. This is the beginning. No? Okay.
Why does the Torah start here and not in Matan Torah?
Okay, excellent. Well, it doesn't say Matan Torah. Why does the Torah start with the beginning of creation? So let's read what Rashi says. I'm a Rabbi Yitzchak. Right? There's a big debate who Rabbi Yitzchak is. One opinion is that it's his father. I'm a Rabbi Yitzchak. Lo haya tzarich la'tchil ta Torah ela me'achodesh hazeh lachem. We shouldn't have had to start the Torah from the beginning of creation. We should have started the Torah from Achodesh hazeh lachem, when Hashem tells the Jewish people, really Moshe, and Moshe tells the Jewish people, that this will be for you a new moon, right? Gives him the first mitzvah that the Jewish people are given as a people. And that mitzvah is the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. Is it an appropriate time to talk about this? Because this Sunday, Monday is Rosh Chodesh. I'm going to send everybody the molad because you're in quarantine. I don't know if you're going to be able to hear the molad. At least you should know what it is. Saturday night at about 3 a.m., the moon, the cycle of the previous moon ends. There's an exact moment. The new moon begins. It's very strange, first of all, that the beginning of a cycle of time is completely indiscernible to the human eye. You can't see it. And two witnesses to come and desperately find some glimmer of light in the sky somewhere and say the moon has returned, the sun has peaked over the edge of the earth and is now reflecting light. The moon can reflect light to us and so on and so forth. So that's where the Torah should have started. That's what Rashi says. Before we get to Rashi's answer, what's bothering Rashi? Why was the Torah created at the beginning of Rashi? Now let's think about that question. That doesn't make a lot of sense. Where else would you start the Torah? Well, what is Rashi suggesting? That we should skip all the stories of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? That we shouldn't know how we got down to Egypt? That we should just start in the middle of the story? That makes no sense. And not only that, if I'm going to listen to the Torah, I have to believe that the creator, the source of Torah, created everything. So it actually makes a lot of sense. And this isn't my question. There are many Mefarshim who talk about this. Rav Soloveitchik has a magnificent drasha on this. So Rashi's question is a question, right? Now, what would you have to say in order to accept Rashi's question? In order for it to make sense that the Torah should start from the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, of the lunar calendar, what would you have to say? Anybody want to take a guess? Eitan Pomper, the Pomper Dicker Rebbe. Go ahead, what do you think? Anybody? No? Nobody? Really? Yeah, Mendy?
I mean, I don't know. Maybe that, like, it's supposed to be like the Torah is not a history book, so it doesn't need to be going in any specific order.
Okay, so the Torah is obviously not a history book if we're not starting from the beginning of creation. So what would the Torah have to be if we're starting from the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people? What would the Torah have to be? It's not a history book. It's a book of
laws.
Of laws, of mitzvot. If the Torah is meant to be a book of mitzvot, then it makes sense to start with the first mitzvah that the Jewish people are given. By the way, is that the first mitzvah in the Torah? What's the first mitzvah in the Torah? Anybody know?
Fruitful.
That you shall be fruitful and multiply. So if Rashi says it's a book of mitzvot, then we should really start from Puruvu. Maybe you don't start from creation, but we should start from the creation of man. So it can't be that it's just a book of mitzvot. By the way, what's the other mitzvah that appears in Sefer Breshit? Anybody know? Rafi? Rafi Tob, yeah?
No, I don't know the answer, but I want to ask some. Yeah, I want to ask another question.
Well, hang on one second. What's the other mitzvah questions that appears in it, yeah, Eitan Pomper? Or that's not Eitan. Who's that? Walking with his hand up in a blue
band. Yeah, that's Eitan.
Oh, it is Eitan. Now, you don't look like Eitan with his earphones. Yeah?
Hachnasat Orchim?
Hachnasat Orchim is alluded to. Okay? First of all, Hachnasat Orchim is not a mitzvah d'oraita. That's an interesting question. Having guests, it's a good idea. It's a mitzvah. The actual mitzvah is v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, to love your fellow Jew. Right? And that, based on that mitzvah, we should have guests. Right, ve'avta tager, love the stranger. Based on that mitzvah, we should have guests. Right, we don't need multiple mitzvah for no reason. Now, the other mitzvah that's given in the Torah is the mitzvah of Brit Milah. right? Avram Avinu is told he has to get a bris. Those are the two mitzvot that are in Breishit. Now, it's interesting that if you look up in the Rambam, in the Sefer HaMitzvot, or the Ramban, or many of the other authorities, none of them list, Sefer HaChinuch, none of them list the mitzvah of Brit Milah. Actually, I have to look up the Sefer HaChinuch. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm sure about the Rambam. The mitzvah of Brit Milah actually appears in Vayikra, right? It appears around Tazria, around whatever. I have to look that up as well, because I didn't, when there was a lot going on today. But it's not listed as appearing in Breishit. So even though it appears in Breishit, the actual mitzvah comes later. The mitzvah of Pruvu, however, to have children, procreation, that actually appears in Breishit. You would have to therefore say that when Rashi is saying it's a book of mitzvot, he's saying it's a book of mitzvot for the Jewish people. And if it's a book of mitzvot for the Jewish people, then really it should start with the creation of the Jewish people as a people accepting mitzvot. And that happens with the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. Now, by the way, that raises another question. Why is the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people the mitzvah of celebrating the new moon? I mean, I can think of, wouldn't you start with something more, start with Shabbat, start with Kashrut, start with faith, with Emunah? Why would you start with the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh? So the truth is that the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, the mitzvah of the new moon, is actually the mitzvah of time, right? It's the obligation and the opportunity for us to sanctify time. Right? There's nothing holier in this world than the time that we're given. It's the only thing that's completely irreplaceable. Right? People say time is money. Time is not money. Time is life. That's what the Lubavitcher Rebbe said. And he's right. Right? The Jewish people are getting out of slavery. They're leaving Egypt behind. The first gift Hashem gives us is the gift of time. Because when you're a slave, your time is not your own. All of a sudden we're told, that's your biggest responsibility. What do you do with the time that you're given? Okay. But let's get back to Breishit. So Rashi says that the world should start, that the Torah should start with mitzvot, and we should understand that this is a book that teaches us how to sanctify time. So then you're left with an interesting question. So then why do we start with Breishit? Right? Why do we start with Breishit? By the way, I'm leaving aside the moment. Even if Rashi is correct, you would still have to start with Breishit, because how would you know? Like, you need to know the background, right? I agree that with what Mendy said, that the Torah is definitely not a history book. I mean, just as an example, the Parsha of Breishit, which spans hundreds of millions, billions of years, right? You know, the first day is the creation of light, the fourth day is the creation of the sun. What's a day without the sun? If we don't have the sun, it's not a day the way we know it. So a day is a period of time. It could be 1,000 years, it could be 1 billion years. Right? All of creation and history up until the creation of man could be billions of years. And all of that is in one portion, right? All the way until Noah, which is hundreds of years. On the other hand, you look at Parshat Sefer Dvarim, the whole book of Deuteronomy, and that's a book that takes 30 days. So one book takes 30 days, and one portion is billions of years. Obviously, it's not a history book. There are major events in history that are missing in the Torah, right? Without starting to list them. So it's not a history book, that I buy. If Rashi's correct, it's a book of mitzvot, so then we're still left with the question, why do we start with creation? Why is that the way to begin the story of the book of mitzvot? Okay? So before we get to what Rashi says, yeah, Rafi, you have a question?
Maybe the answer to that is you could see, like, Bereshit, creation, creative works, engaging, like, creativity to be some kind of a commandment as well. I think Rav Soloveitchik talks about that, actually.
So it is true, Rav Soloveitchik talks about it. Soloveitchik has a number of famous articles on this topic. One of them details the difference between Adam 1 and Adam 2, the different types of personalities and who we are based on the story of creation as at the beginning of the Torah and the story of creation later in Perek Gimel. But putting all that aside, I want to look at Rashi. Let's take a look at Rashi. Yeah, Mendy?
I was thinking because, yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I was thinking because, like, the first mitzvah is the new moon, and, like, that's the mitzvah of time. Breishit is the beginning of all time, so that is the first time where we have time. So it should be that it starts then.
Oh, okay. That would be a great idea. And we could connect to that. There'd be two problems with that. First problem is, then why does the Torah have to include all of the stories in the middle? Why do I need to know that Yitzchak is digging wells for Avram Avinu? Right? If we got the idea that Hashem created time, we could have the book, the Parsha of Bereshit, the creation of man, and then it could just say, you know, and Adam begat Shait, and Shait begat, you know, all the way down to Lemach and Noach, and then we got to Avram, and then we got to, and we got to Mitzrayim, and all that could be in one portion. And then the second portion is now the Jews are getting out of Egypt. Hachodesh Zalachem, right? Time. But we have all these stories in the middle. So that is a whole discussion about why we need those stories and why we need role models, which I think you'll be able to figure out on your own when we finish this discussion. But let's get back to Rashi. So the second problem, Mendy, with what you're saying is that Rashi doesn't say that. That would be an obvious answer. We start with Bereshit, and this is how it relates to HaChodesh Zalachem. Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi gives a completely different answer. Out of left field. What does he say? Right? Umatam patach bebreshit. Why does the Torah open up with Bereshit? With Genesis, with the creation. Mishum koach ma'asav yigid lamo Hashem. It's a pasuk in Tehillim Kuf Yud Aleph, 111. Hashem, by virtue of Hashem's actions, Hashem tells us things, right? We learn from what Hashem does. Latet lahem nachalat goyim. That's the continuum. To give them an inheritance amongst the nations. Right? In other words, Hashem wants us to be sure. The Torah begins with the idea that one day we are meant to have a place. We're meant to have a land that's our own. This is the ultimate Zionist comment, that the whole Torah begins with an allusion to Eretz Israel, to the land of Israel. Right? She'im yomru umot ha'olam, that if the nations of the world say to Israel, listimatem, you are thieves, shekavashtem artzot shiva goyim, that you've conquered the lands of the seven nations, right? The Girgashites and the Chittites and the Yevusites, etc., right? We chased them out or destroyed them. Heim omrim lahem, the Jews then will be able to say to those who claim this, kol ha'aretz shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the whole land, the whole world is God's. Hu bra'av v'netna la'asher yashar be'nav. Hashem created it. Hashem gives it to whoever he thinks should have it. Hashem gave the land of Israel to the Canaanites. That was what his desire. That was the Ratzon Hashem. And then eventually he took it from them and he gave it to us. You can't claim that we stole the land because Hashem created the world and Hashem gives it to us. Now there are two problems with this Rashi. Don't forget your question, Eitan and Rafi. There are two problems with this Rashi. You can hold your hand up all the time if you want, but I'll get to you, Rafi Tope. You can relax, right? Okay? So... there are two problems with this Rashi. First problem with this Rashi is, what does this have to do with the beginning of Bereshit? Like, Rashi is saying this is a book of mitzvot. It's a book of mitzvot of the Jewish people. But we're going to start the world making sure that everybody knows why we get the land of Israel. Right? That's a rather strange progression of thought. So that's the first issue to think about. Well, what does that mean? What does that have to do with the beginning of the Torah? Right? Hashem gave it to them, and now he gave it to us. The second is, look, on the one hand, it's amazing that Rashi lived from the year 1040 to 1105. So sometime towards the end of the 11th century, in the middle of Christendom, possibly Rashi lived through the horrendous years of 1099, the Crusades. He saw whole Jewish communities wiped out. And in the middle of this, Rashi is saying, one day, when we're back in the land of Israel, and people say we stole the land, we're going to be able to say Hashem gave it to us. Now, can you imagine if a medieval crusader bursts into Rashi's study, and he's about to kill him, and he sees he's writing a book. He says, what are you writing about? So I'm writing a commentary on the Torah. He says, well, tell me read me the first section. The guy would have laughed his head off, and then he would have cut Rashi's head off. Like, that's ridiculous. And here we are, 1,000 years later, and that's exactly our reality. People are saying we stole this land. What does this have to do with the beginning of the Torah? Why does this need to be here? By the way, it's interesting. Just like the Torah begins with an allusion to Eretz Israel, it also ends with an allusion to Eretz Israel. In fact, without this could be a shiur in and of itself, but when you think about the brachot, the blessings that were given in Zot HaBracha, many of them are about Israel's borders, right? Dan Yezanek Min HaBashan, Dan sort of leaps forth from the Bashan. The Bashan was the Golan. That's Israel's northern border. Baruch Malchiv Gad. Blessed is he who spreads out the portion of God, which is the western border, right? Naphtali Yam V'Darom Yerasha. Naphtali inherits the sea. That's our western, right? All these, sorry, eastern and western and northern, right? There's a whole, never mind that, that the book of Dvarim, the last 30 days, is about, is very much linked to Moshe's request to get into Eretz Yisrael. So the Torah ends with the Jewish people about to enter Eretz Yisrael, and it begins with an allusion to the fact that Eretz Yisrael belongs to us because Hashem gave it to us. What does this have to do with the beginning of the Torah, right? Why is this, right? One more question. Let's look at another story in the book of Bereshit, okay? The story of Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel, okay? So the story of Cain and Hevel in Perek Dalet is a very strange story, okay? It does not make a lot of sense on so many different levels, and I actually think that that's part of the goal of the story, right? V'ha Adam yada et chava ishto, you will all recognize this pasuk, right? Adam knew even a biblical sense, v'tar v'telet et Cain, she gives birth to Cain, right? Vatomer kaniti isha Hashem, and she names him, I have acquired a relationship with Hashem. Somehow birth allows, develops my relationship with Hashem. And that's a whole interesting discussion, not for now. Fatosef laledet, she continues to give birth. This time it doesn't say vatahar, it doesn't say she became pregnant. And therefore the commentary suggests this proves that Cain and Hevel were twins. Now, Hashem has set the stage for the fact that the first brotherhood mentioned in the Torah, perhaps the first brotherhood ever, is designed for brotherhood. Like, who is closer than twins? They share the womb. They share birth. They should be the closest. There's no one else in the world, right? And then they start to argue, right? So one of them, right? Vehi Hevel Roitza. Abel is a shepherd. V'kain Hayahu V'dada. And Cain is a farmer. This is pretty simple, right? There should be no problem here. If they were both farmers, maybe they argue about the best crops, but they're not even... You're an engineer and he's a doctor. You should never argue. You should just want to help each other. Right? Makes sense. And then they start to argue. And if you look at this, right? So one of them brings an offering. Then the other one brings an offering. One of them brings the best. One of them doesn't. Hashem likes this one, doesn't like that one. That's a whole complicated story. Maybe Hashem is partially responsible. Not for now. An interesting discussion, but not for now. And Cain gets upset. V'al Cain v'al minchato lo sha'ah. Hashem does not prefer Cain's offering. V'yichar l'Cain mo'ad v'yiplu panav. Cain gets upset. And he's angry. Right? He's upset. V'yom Hashem, this is unbelievable. You know, let's say statistically 70 guys are in quarantine. Somebody's having a tough day. Right? And we may not notice it. But let's say Rav Blau, you know, calls him up and says, let's shmooze. So he feels like, wow, that's really special. When Rosh Hashiva called me up, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to talk to Cain. It doesn't get better than this. You don't need a therapist after you talk to God. God is the ultimate therapist. So what does he say? Why are you upset? Right? This is the second of many questions that Hashem will ask man in the Bible, in the Torah. These questions are obviously not because Hashem needs to know the answer. They're opportunities for us to think about something. But okay. Why are you upset? Why are you looking so down? If you can become, you can rise above this. You can make good of this. And if you do, you will carry this. All the challenges we have in life are given to us. We have the ability. It's up to us. It's a decision. You can sit in a room, right, on a balcony overlooking the old city and be in a state of awe that you're in Yerushalayim. Or you can be miserable that you can't walk outside. It's up to you. It's totally up to you. Right? Up to us. That's this the beginning of the Torah, right? But then, Vayomer Cain al Hevel Achiv, out of the blue, Cain engages Hevel in discussion. Vayhi biotam basaden, it was when they were in the field, Vayakam Cain al Hevel Achiv, Vayargeu. Cain rises up against his brother and kills him. First murder. First tragedy. First destruction. First loss of enormous potential. Now, there's a fascinating detail in this pasuk. First question is, we don't know what they're arguing about. It doesn't say they argue. It says Cain spoke to Hevel. It never says what Cain said. So the Medrash fills in the picture. The Medrash says, well, Cain was a farmer and Hevel was a shepherd. So they get into an argument, right? So Cain says to Hevel, you're walking on my land, right? Because Cain took all the land. And Hevel took all the metaltel and all the perishables, all the material. You're walking on my land. So Hevel says, well, you know, you're wearing my clothes. Like, sheep provide all the wool skin clothing and you're wearing it. It's mine. So Cain says, well, fly. If you are my land, you need to get off my land. Fly. So Hevel says to Cain, go naked. And that's the argument in the Medrash. And then it goes on to another topic. That's a crazy Medrash. Well, what is that Medrash even talking about? What? So, and why doesn't the Torah tell me what they said? That's the most important point in the story. So I've always felt that what the Torah is trying to tell me is if one human being can murder another human being, it doesn't matter what they said. There is something illogical at the root of machloket. There is something that does not make sense. Right? If one brother could lift up his hand against them, what's the difference what they're arguing about? Something's wrong. By the way, even in an instance where you absolutely know you're right, there's still something wrong. If I'm in a tank in Beirut, and I have to shoot a 105mm tank shell at a 6 or 7 year old kid holding an RPG, and I am absolutely sure I did the right thing, and 40 years later I'm convinced I did the right thing, it should still bother me. There's something illogical at the root of the fact that a 7-year-old kid can be holding an RPG. And that should be bothering me forever. That is the root of the story of Cain and Hevel. But wait, it gets better. Okay? So now, Cain kills Hevel, and he buries him. That's the first bury. Where are you going to hide him? Well, Cain owns the land. So he puts him in the land. And that's a whole deep discussion about ownership and what it means to bury someone. I'm not going to go there right now. So now Hashem comes back to Cain. Vayomer Hashem el Cain, ei Hevel achicha, where's Hevel, your brother? This is a remarkable dialogue. Like, you're Cain. You're the son of Adam Arishon. And God is talking to you. Have you not figured out that God knows everything? Didn't your dad tell you the story of the tree where God comes looking and knows what's wrong? There is, by the way, one day that says that all of this happens before they leave Gan Eden. That's an interesting discussion, but most of the authorities don't agree with that. But that would explain why this. So Cain starts to. Hashomer achi anochi, am I my brother's keeper? That is the foundation of machloket. That I don't believe that I am responsible for my fellow human being. Every time a moment loses the opportunity to feel responsible for his fellow human being, he is reliving the illogical debate of Cain and Hevel. If you walk into the dining room and there's some schmutz on the table, if you get up tonight from Shabbos dinner, and it doesn't matter whether you're in your room with a few friends or you're in the dining room with the negatives or whatever it is, and you get up and you don't even notice that one of the tables isn't done, you don't care enough about your fellow human being. It is that simple. It's not about obligation. It's about opportunity, right? But okay. So now listen to what happens here. Vayomer me'asita. Hashem says to him, what'd you do? Right? That's the essential question we have to struggle with. Kol d'me achicha tzorkim alei min ha'adama. Your brother's blood is calling out to me from the land. Now, you are going to be cursed from the land that opened up its door. Now, we're not studying the story of Cain and Hevel in depth. It's interesting why the consequence for murder has to do with the land. Why is the land here? But okay. Ki tavodet ha'adama, when you work the land, lo tosef tet kochalach, it will no longer give its strength to you. Right? Na v'nad tiyeh ba'aretz, you're going to be a wanderer. You've lost your life now. Right? Now, this isn't just somebody telling me, you know, listen, because of what you did, we're never going to allow you to be a doctor. I have no interest in being a doctor, so it wouldn't really bother me. But if somebody tells me because I spoke Lashon Hara, I'm no longer allowed to speak, that'd be very difficult because that's what I do. Cain is a farmer. Hashem says, you're not going to be able to farm anymore. You can farm as much as you want. Nothing's going to grow. You're going to be a wanderer. So what does a wanderer do? So first of all, it's interesting. Vayomer Cain, what is Cain? What is Cain's reaction? Vayomer Cain al Hashem, gadol avonim minso. My transgression is too great to bear. What is Cain actually doing there? He's recognizing that he made a mistake. He's regretting it. Tshuva. Right? Hein gerashto te'ayom el pnei adama mipanecha esatera. I understand the consequence of my action. What is the ultimate consequence of our transgressions? We become distant. Right? The greatest punishment, the greatest consequence that God forbid a person receives if he adulters is he becomes distanced from the person that he's meant to love most in the world. Right? If you hit somebody, the consequence is not what happens to them. That's their consequence. The consequence is you've become distant from another human being. That's the ultimate. And the ultimate consequence is I become distant from Hashem. Consequence of the chait of Eitz Hadaat, that mistake, was that they're forced to leave Gan Eden. And I will be a Navanat, I will be a wanderer. So Hashem gives him a sign and everything else that's going on. Now listen to this. This is our last point here before we can get to understanding all this. Right? Vayetze Kain Milifnei Hashem. So Kain leaves God. That's a very powerful line. Remember we said that tshuva has to be before Hashem? This is the source. Kain has this dialogue before Hashem, but now he leaves being before Hashem. Leaving being before Hashem is not a good place to go. That's a problem. Right? Vayeda Kain. Right? Vayeshev Beretz Nod. And he lives in the land of Nod. So I don't understand. It just told me that he's going to be a wanderer. Hashem says he's going to be a wanderer. And then it says Kain goes and he sets up shop in Nod. He goes to live somewhere. So I don't understand. You're not a wanderer. Not only does he goes to live in the land of Nod, right? He gives birth to a son called Chanoch, Vatelet et Chanoch, Vahi Boneir, and he builds a city. Vahi Krashem Ayir Kishem Beno Chanoch. And he names the city Chanoch after his son. So, how is the wanderer putting down roots and building a city? I thought he's supposed to be a wanderer. And why do I need to know what he calls the city, what he calls his son? So I want to suggest an idea, okay? And there's going to be a lot more for you to think about, but this is at least an idea. If you can kill your brother, you will forever be a wanderer. You know where Cain goes to live? He goes to live in the land of Nod. Nod is the same root as Navanad, to be a wanderer. It doesn't matter where he puts down roots. He will be a wanderer forever. You know? I remember once, it's a longer story, so I won't share it now. I think I might have once told it to you, but I remember once being in Miluim, and we caught a terrorist, a person who tried to kill one of my men with an axe. And, you know, I don't know how you call it in English. There's these things called azikonim that you put on a guy's wrists. We wrist cuffed him behind his back. We sat him down. We blindfolded him. That's what you're supposed to do. We called up the battalion, right? And they're supposed to come collect him and, you know, whatever, find out if he was just a, you know, sort of somebody who lost it, or if he's actually a terrorist, or all the things that they do. Okay. Now, this guy's now tied up. He's a terrorist. I mean, he just tried to kill someone with an axe. This is not someone who tried to push you off the... I mean, you got to be a pretty violent type of personality to want to kill somebody with an axe. And these guys were, you know, the guy who almost got killed, who was saved simply because he was wearing a jerry can on his back. I mean, these guys were all... We were in reserve duty. They were his closest buddies. They fought in the Yom Kippur War with him. And one of the guys lost it. And he slams this terrorist over the head. And I had to stop him. And we had a little bit of an altercation. Some of the men, I was a very young officer. I'd only just started the reserves. These guys were veterans. And some of them were like, look, you know, let him be. This guy's going to get what's coming to him. And fortunately, one of the guys stood up with me and said, listen, you know, guys, let's just calm down. I look back at that story. It must have been 30 years ago. I still remember that story. Because I know that if I would have let something happen to that terrorist under my watch with his hands tied behind his back, I would have lived with that forever. I would have wandered forever. We wander with the issues that we can't let go of. And the reason we have a hard time letting go of them is because we understand the mistake that we made. Right? So if Cain is a wanderer and he's struggling with his mistake, then the Torah has to share with me that he's trying to fix his mistake. How is he fixing his mistake? He does two things. He settles down in a place and he builds and names that place Chanoch. He names his son Chanoch. Now what is Chanoch? Chanoch is the root of chinuch, of education. It's a famous pasuk in Mishlei, Chanoch lanar arpi darko. You have to educate a child according to his path. You know, some kids, their intellects, send them to Rav Blau Shir, Rav David Shir, or Gavriel Shir. Some kids, they're souls. They need to be reached spiritually. That's a different Shir, right? The boy who's sitting in Rav David Shir and the boy who's sitting in Rav Blau, they obviously share a lot in common, but they also have different things that they need. That's the foundation of Chinuch. Chinuch, by the way, is to find the beauty that's already inside of me and bring it out. Cain understands that the root of the issue is chinuch, is education. If he's going to fix his mistake, he has to make sure that he creates a future that's different. And he does that in two ways. He has a child. He names the child Chanoch because he understands that the root issue here is education. Right? He was born of a father who never had siblings, who never knew what it was to grow up. You know, how could Adam and Chava, how do I teach my children? You know, why is it that they suggest that when a person experiences abuse as a child, he's more likely to abuse his children? And there are people, I've had students who work very hard to make sure that you can totally overcome the mistakes of your past. You just have to be aware of them and figure them out, right? If a person was born of an alcoholic whose father and grandfather and great-grandfather, he's more likely to be an alcoholic, so he's got to work hard to fix that, right? Most of the successes that I think Hashem has blessed me to have with my children came because I watched my parents. And they watched their parents. That's how it works. But Cain and Hevel, their parents never grew up. They don't know what it is to bring somebody up. And Hashem never teaches them how to do this. This is the paradigm. It's the blueprint for our existence. We have to learn. We don't get all the answers. So Cain understands, Cain feels. And this may be part of that, what happens in terms of God's role in the story of Cain and Hevel. That we got set up in a certain way. But I'm not stuck in my setup. I can fix the future. And so he builds a city. Now, what's the difference between a city and a home? When you build a home, you're on your own. You live in your home. It separates you from everybody else. I'm in my home. You're in yours. When we live in a city, the whole purpose of a city is that people live together. That was the root foundational issue that Cain needs to fix. Because Cain has one other human being with whom he has to get along, and he can't do it. And only too late does he realize what a loss that is. He will grow for the rest of his life without his brother. He doesn't have another brother. So he's at least going to fix it for the future. That's the blueprint on which the continuity of humankind is based. And that is the root issue. The root issue that the world has to deal with is education. You know where all this anger and hatred is spewing out in the airwaves? It's because people haven't been educated properly. I promise you, no matter what Rav Lichtenstein ever thought of a different candidate, you would never hear him talk like that, right? How could it be that we're still fighting Arabs 100 years later? Because they're teaching their kids to hate. And sometimes we teach our kids to hate, and that's the flaw. If we don't undo that, we can never fix the future. The root of everything we do is education. And just like the root is education, there has to be an educator. There has to be somebody. Now, by the way, any teacher worth his salt who thinks he's better than his students is not worthy of being a teacher. Any officer worth his salt who thinks he's better than his men will never be a proper officer. Right? A melech, a king, a navi, the Kohen Gadol, they're anointed with oil because the oil on their forehead reminds them the oil is the vehicle for light, it's not the light. So the Jewish people are not better than the rest of the world. The teacher is not better. But they're meant to be a role model. They're meant to be educators. Now, in order to teach, in order to be a role model, you have to have a place to model what it is that you're teaching. You want to know why the story of Bereshit, the whole book of Bereshit, is so important? It's important because in the book of Bereshit, we discover our role models. The second mitzvah the Rambam brings in Hilchot Deot, Lehi Dabek Biyodav. If you don't have role models in your life, you're missing something fundamental. You're missing the ability to discover a healthy education, right? So the book of Bereshit is designed to teach me. It tells me the stories of how I'm supposed to be. But then I need a place to model that. And that's Eretz Yisrael. And that's why at the beginning of the Torah, it's true it's a book of mitzvot. It's true there has to be a recipe that we live our lives by so that we can be a model that the world can emulate to some degree. But in order to be that model, in order to fulfill our purpose, we have to have a place. Everything in life needs a place. Right? If something doesn't have a place, it can't fulfill its purpose. If you don't know where you put your car keys, you'll never start your car. And every nation is a nation because it has a place. And the reason it needs a place is because that's how it fulfills its purpose. We have our place. So all the way at the beginning of the Torah, Rashi is saying, understand that the end game here, which is to educate the world, starts with knowing that you have a place. And even though as individuals we can make a difference in the world wherever we are, the nation of Israel will never fully achieve its purpose until it lands completely in the land of Israel. If there was ever a time when we're starting to realize that that's so, it's now. That's exactly what the world is going through. You know? And to the degree that we're able to at least educate ourselves and become better role models as human beings, as tribes, as a nation, the world will be better off. So that's a little food for thought on Parshat Bereshit. There's obviously a lot more to talk about, but let's stop here on Parashat Bereishit. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom, and really have a wonderful Shabbos and a good week ahead.